Thank you very much. Jody Heyman is our next speaker. She's the Canada Research Chair, Global Health and Social Policy. She's a professor of epidemiology and biostatistics and also the founding director for the Institute for Health and Social Policy here at McGill. Would you please welcome Jody Heyman?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's great to be at a meeting that's really covering the full range of social determinants of health and what business and the private sector can do about it. We work on the Business Health Compact at the Institute in several ways. I just want to mention briefly one of the ways I'm not going to talk about today just because of time, but because it may interest people here, and I'd happily be in touch later. If you think about how the compact's formed, right, it's formed in at least two ways. One, what businesses do voluntarily. We're going to hear some more exciting things about that later. But also what the public sector does and what society does to structure the framework in which businesses operate. I'm going to talk about that second primarily today. But I will say in terms of what businesses do on their own, we have an initiative. It's called Profit at the Bottom of the Ladder. It's a little different than what I think we're going to hear about later on this afternoon from companies, in that it focuses on how transforming conditions for the poorest workers, for those with the least skills, can lead to economic success, both for the workers and for the company. And I'm happy to talk about that more later with anybody interested. Before we dive into what the public sector is doing to frame this around the world, and this will follow, I think, very naturally on the earlier talk about the social protection floor, I'm just going to talk about the labor floor. I do want to tell you about one person. We started our initiative. We now have looked at public policies in 192 of 192 UN nations. On the labor side, we've got data on 190 out of 192. I just got back recently from the South Pacific, so we can fill in those two little gaps. But before we did that, we went and talked to people around the world, including in-depth interviews of more than 2,000 people working anywhere from the factory floor to CEOs in a dozen countries to get an understanding of what was going on the ground. And I'd like, as we're going through the data, for you to think about one of them, because I think it does, his experience does crystallize this link. And his name is Luis, and I met Luis in Tegucigalpa. How many people have been to Tegucigalpa? Okay, how many people know where Tegucigalpa is? Okay, good. We have a few more hands. So it's the capital of Honduras. It's built on these escarpments, so very steep-walled. The poorest people live on the worst part. Not surprisingly, they live on the place that's most vulnerable. As we were hearing in the last session about cities, their housing has big impacts. I went there after Hurricane Mitch had led to massive mudslides, destroying many of the homes. Anyway, during the visit, I met a lot of people, but one of the people I met was Luis. And what was unusual about Luis is I met him at 10 in the morning. And he was there at home cradling his son, named after him, Luisito. Now, there just aren't a lot of men in the slum cradling their 10-month-old during the daytime. So I went and talked to him. I said, okay, you know, what happened? Why are you here at home with him? Well, so here's why he was at home. He and his wife both had factory jobs. She got 6 weeks of paid maternity leave. The end of 6 weeks, she had to go back. That was the legal minimum in the country at the time. So she goes back, and she stops breastfeeding. We know the statistic. The statistics are if you're not breastfeeding, you're 3 to 5 times as likely to get pneumonia, to get diarrheal disease, malnutrition, and die. And in fact, what happens to Luisito, like clockwork, just like the statistics, is he gets pneumonia. Well, in Honduras, like many poor countries, your family has to be at the hospital with you or you're not going to eat because there's nobody else there to feed you. You've got to bring the food in. So the mother and father take turns taking that time off. First day, the father is told, if you miss another day, you'll lose your job. The second day that he has to miss in this alternating scheme, which is the best they can do, he's told, don't come back. And the third day, his job is gone. But that's not all that happens. Eventually, Luisito gets better, and his dad starts looking for factory jobs. But he never gets them. He lines up, and when he gets to the front of the line, he's told there are no jobs, but the people behind him get jobs. He's been blacklisted. So I think what's clear from their experience, but also that of thousands of other people we interviewed and tens of thousands that we studied, the working conditions had this dramatic impact on their health, on the family economics. Had the wife had sufficient maternity leave, Luisito probably never would have been sick in the first place. Had she had breastfeeding breaks even when she returned to work, he wouldn't have been sick. Had they had sick days, they wouldn't have lost their jobs. But none of those were in place. Now, these are all globally recognized rights. They're recognized in ILO conventions. They're recognized in UN conventions. And they're all fundamental social determinants of health. But as a world community, we haven't done enough about it. So we focus on actionable research at the Institute, projects that help you move from research to change. And our question was, what can we do about this? And it seemed like one of the most important things that a small group could do when you're not a massive UN organization, but you have the advantage of the Margaret Mead-esque small group of highly committed people, and you don't have some of the constraints of these larger organizations, is to work on some of the public accountability. All the countries have signed off. Are the laws in place? Are they being implemented? Starting to make that information available. So that's what I'm going to show you a bit about today. I'm going to show you the piece on labor conditions because that's what our panel focuses on. But I will mention that this initiative, which is called WORLD, which is an acronym for World Legal Rights Database, the rights and legislative database is turned around so you can get the acronym. In WORLD, we look at labor rights for adults, we look at labor conditions for kids, we look at education, we look at poverty, we look at equity policy. Because it's a massive project to do this for all the world's countries, we're rolling them out one at a time. We'll roll them out over a 3 or 4 year period. The labor piece was just released 2 days ago, so we'll get to what the website is on that. Oh, because our goal is not only for anybody who's working in the field to have the information, but as part of the accountability, for civil society to be able to access it. So the data I'm going to show you now is available on the web. You can go over, you can look at the world map, see how your country is doing, how it compares to the rest of the world. It's up right now just in English, but will be up across several UN languages by the time we're done. Okay, I'm going to go straight to some examples. So our team looked at labor legislation in 190 countries. We had this huge benefit from the great work that the ILO had done to collect a lot of the labor legislation. We also had the benefit of not being at the UN or the ILO because I think there are challenges for some of the UN organizations to get sign-off from all countries to make readily transparent public data on who's doing well and who's doing poorly. And we've had some limits on accountability because of that. So as a result, just take the labor codes as an example. If you want to know what Luis could have and people like him around the world, you can get 20,000 pages of labor legislation from NATLEX. But you can't get a simple map before that says what are the countries that aren't doing well, and that's what we're trying to change. We're also trying to look at where the global community is and where it's made progress and whether it's economically feasible. Okay, here's paid maternity leave. So this is the first map, so I'll just take a second longer on it. Red means you have none. Anybody else here from the U.S. besides me? Okay, I'm sorry for the 3 or 4 from the United States. You're going to see that the U.S. is red on a lot of these maps. That's why it was. That's why I couldn't be with everybody for the first couple of days, because I was at a congressional briefing to release it. The U.S. is one of the countries furthest behind the rest of the world. Now, the darker the color, the blue, the better policy that you have. So this just looks at duration of maternity leave. By the way, while Australia is red now, they've already committed to starting paid maternity leave in 2011. Now, we're talking about economic viability at the same time, so I do want to mention, as I go through these, that we looked at each time whether you could, for example, have long maternity leave and still be economically successful as a country. So we took the business rankings from the World Economic Forum of the 130 countries who are the most economically competitive year in, year out for a decade. Of those, 13 of the 15 have paid maternity leave. Of the lowest unemployment countries in the OECD, 12 of the 13 have paid maternity leave. If you look at the global unemployment numbers, we look at OECD too, because the global numbers aren't always so reliable. Again, the low unemployment countries tend to have this. Now, maternity leave is good news, but, you know, it would be good for people like Luis, and I did purposely start with the story of a father. If we were equally invested in paid paternity leave, I hope even the people in the back row can see this map is a lot more red. That's because as a global community, we have not done so well when it comes to paid paternity leave. So the good news is 74 countries have it. The bad news is over 100 countries don't. The other bad news is that much of it is for very short periods of time. And the parts in Europe and Canada that do have longer paid leave, it's mainly through parental leave that's gender neutral. Okay, what about sick days? I've noticed a few people are coughing here, probably doing a great job being vectors, spreading H1N1 to their neighbors. But you could have stayed home, all of you, I think, because your jobs, you're just fascinated by this fabulous conference, so you came. But of course, many people, like Louise, like others we've interviewed, cannot stay home. That's true in affluent countries as well. In the United States, there are 60 million people without paid sick leave. It's an enormous number. In Canada, if you're in a province that has it, you're well off. You have no job protection, though, at all in four provinces and territories. Now, that matters, of course, to not only spread of infectious disease at the workplace, but it matters to what food you get at a restaurant. It matters to caregivers. How's the world doing on that as a standard? And I will, at the end, I promise, for those who are already worried about this, get to implementation in the informal sector. So as a standard, at least taking that first step, which is just a first step, do you have that legal right? And our data of in-depth study shows having the legal right, whether it's in countries with low implementation or high implementation, is better than not having the legal right. When you hold constant for governance, the legal right matters. So the good news is most of the world has the legal right to sick leave. 163 countries do. You can see the United States doesn't. India doesn't at a countrywide level, though some states do. But still, the most competitive countries, 14 out of 15, do. This is completely affordable. Now, the world has transformed in terms of who's in the workplace. And we've studied this across all regions. And if you look over the past 40 years, this is not unique to anyone. In every single region, the number of households in which all adults are in the workplace has increased. This has increased in the Middle East, just like it has in Africa, Asia, or North America. The starting levels are different in different parts of the world, but it's increased everywhere. That means that workers' ability to care for the health of their family members has become increasingly important. So we look at whether people can take that leave. We know it has dramatic health impacts. This just lists a few of them. Well, here again is the good news, bad news story. The good news story was the world has really put in place the legislation needed, the rights for caring for your own health. But look at how red the map is when it comes to caring for your kids' health. Much of the world doesn't have it. That's particularly true of the poor countries, and this is, I think, reflecting some of the earlier presentations that where it's needed the most, it's often there the least. So families living in poverty who are at the $1 or $2 a day who really cannot afford to take that leave are the ones who are most likely not to have it at all. And we know from in-depth studies in these countries that means they don't go get immunizations for children, they don't get basic care. The global population is aging. Again, this is a transformation true around the world. And here we see, again, an area where the world has not caught up. The map is quite red, countries with no policy in this area. One last example, just to show this issue of we have to think about how labor, who's working, and how work is structured has changed when we think about what policies are in place. People have worried about overtime work since the founding of the ILO and even before, and as a result, it's not surprising that most countries, even the United States, by the way, have some kind of legislation around overtime work. But when you look at night work and the dramatic rise of evening and night work with profound health consequences, you see a lot more red on the map, another area where there's been much less done. Each of these are completely affordable. I want to end on two notes. The informal economy, this just throws up some numbers for the informal economy by region. The question is often asked, does the legislation matter at all to the informal economy? And to that, I would give, just for time's sake, maybe we can do more in Q&A, a brief, definitely yes. Why does it matter? Paid sick leave of long duration, maternity leave are often social insurance systems that directly cover it. Many countries are developing systems by which formal economy standards are applied in different ways to the informal economy, and it lifts up the competition in terms of what minimum standards any business has to provide. www.raisingtheglobalfloor.org is our website. For the labor data, we'll gradually, as I say, roll out the different pieces of data. What you can do there is you can find out for any of about it's probably 30 different policies. What a country has around the world, you can pick whether you want to compare it to like economies, like regions. You can map the world. You can map subparts. What we hope is that this will begin to be a way that there can be more accountability and transparency. And I'll end with just a 30-second story, which is when we first did this data and talked, I used to go around and talk about the fact that the countries without paid maternity leave, and I did this actually to move the United States, were Lesotho, Liberia, Papua New Guinea, Swaziland, and the United States of America. I haven't yet succeeded in the U.S., but we're getting closer. But I did get an email from Lesotho that I didn't even realize was following this, saying, stop listing us with the United States already. We passed it. We passed paid maternity leave. It's short, we're a poor country, but we have it. Having transparency on what countries have, showing ways that they can change, makes a real difference. Thank you very much.
And there will be time for questions and answers, obviously, when we're done here.